Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with John Michael Varese, whose gorgeous debut novel is The Spirit Photographer. We'll also hear from Renee Hodges, author of the memoir Saving Bobby, Heroes and Heroine in One Small Community. John Michael Varese is a scholar of 19th century literature, so it's no surprise that when he turned to writing fiction, he set his first novel in that time period. The Spirit Photographer is a beautifully written book about a photographer who raises the dead in photos in Boston in 1870 and gets more than he bargained for. John, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm happy to be here.
Now, the spiritualist movement has inspired so much fiction, and rightly so. So I'm curious to know what drew you to this time period.
The spiritualist movement actually began earlier than the time period that the book set in. The book set in 1870, but the spiritualist movement actually began in the 1850s. I wanted to write a story that came after the Civil War, because so much has been written about the Civil War. So much has been written about the spiritualist movement itself. And not a lot has been written, fiction-wise, about the Reconstruction period. So I wanted to set the book there because I thought it would be really fertile ground to explore some of the deeper and darker issues in the book.
Well, one of the things about the spiritualist movement is that it always seemed to me to be the nexus of so many human desires and qualities, loss and grief, the sense of hope of seeing someone again, the idea that someone might be watching over you, that there's some magic that might make that connection possible. And you layer that in with a rich sense of historical guilt about racial issues.
Yes, there's definitely historical guilt woven throughout this book, perhaps equally so historical amnesia. I think we as a country have yet to fully face what happened after the Civil War. We have yet to face, I think, even what happened during and before the Civil War. You know, Reconstruction is a period that is, it's one of the darkest periods in our history. Traditionally, it hasn't been taught very well. And, you know, I kind of viewed it as a big cover-up that needs to be exposed. And this is, you know, this is not me alone, obviously. This is in the air right now. You know, you have people like Bryan Stevenson at the Equal Justice Initiative.
Yeah.
With the lynching memorial. You have, you know, in your own backyard, you have some of the plantations finally starting to acknowledge what went on at the plantations. If you go out to Evergreen, you read some very informative and even dark placards on the slave cabins, where, you know, the slave cabins are perfectly preserved out there at Evergreen. You can't go to Evergreen and not feel it, you know, and that's another thing about just New Orleans itself. I mean, it's why I wanted to set a huge part of the book in New Orleans, because New Orleans is the great city in America where the living and the dead commingle every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no other city in the United States where the dead have such a presence, and particularly the dead of the African American community. I mean, they are everywhere. The slave markets are everywhere. You cannot walk through the French Quarter today and not run into something that reminds us of that history. So we've done a really good job over the past 150 years of covering up that history. But I think what I'm seeing in the cultural movement today is that people are finally ready to start talking about that in a real way that is a healing way. You have to talk about it to heal. This is what Bryan Stevenson is constantly saying. You know, he's a real leader in this conversation. You know, Michelle Alexander, her work on why the prison systems look the way they do today, the prison populations, mm-hmm. You know, this all goes back to Reconstruction, all of it. And to me, that was the setting for a story about a man who is haunted by a ghost from his past.
Well, talk a little bit about your main character, who is based on an historical figure.
So the main character is Edward Moody. He is a photographer who has kind of lost his way. He's based on the real-life William Mumler, who was photographing, actually before the period that I set the book in, as I said earlier. Mumler was photographing earlier during the Civil War and just after the Civil War in the 1860s. And this story about spirit photography is, it's a perfect convergence of historical factors, right? So you have the spiritualist movement coming up in the 1850s. It actually started in New York. And then you have the Civil War, and it hits the country. And I think that, I might not get these figures exactly right, but I think it's one in every four men in the South died in the Civil War, and maybe something like one every out of every six in the North, something like that. But the point being that everyone in the United States in the 1860s knew someone who died, likely had a relative who died. So death and destruction and the afterlife were driving forces in the consciousness of 19th century America. Drew Faust writes about this magnificently in her book, This Republic of Suffering, about how America dealt with death. Americans had never seen death on that scale before. So it was only natural that people would want to reconnect with the dead. The massive death of the Civil War just laid fertile ground for the spiritual movement to come in and take hold.
Well, your story really begins when a senator's wife of the time wants to reconnect with her young dead son in a spirit photograph and goes to have this photo made with her husband, who has grave, grave reservations and resistance. And instead, a young African-American woman appears in the photo, and that sets things in motion and leads your characters to Louisiana, and the scenes here really come alive. So I want you to talk a little bit about doing your research here, what your experiences were as a writer.
Well, I love New Orleans. I've always loved New Orleans. It's the first time I visited there. I'm not a bona fide Southerner because I actually grew up in South Florida, but I'm sort of a Southerner in that way. So, you know, I'm no stranger to the climate, the atmosphere that sort of drives life in the South. I went to school in the North, and then I did my degree out in California, and I lived in California for 20 years, and now I'm back in the North. But I've always loved New Orleans. I have good friends there who I've visited over the years. And I knew that it was the place that Moody would have to go to find out what the answer was to this secret. So I came to New Orleans back in 2013 on my first research trip. I had written about the first 100 pages of the book just before I came. I'd spent about a year writing the first 100 pages of the book. And I got to the point in the book where they need to go to New Orleans. So I got on a plane and I went to New Orleans. And I had sketched out a number of things that I knew would need to happen, you know, the swamp business that takes up a huge portion of the New Orleans section and the quarter. And I knew that Joseph would need to somehow be escaping from the river. Place is very important to me, and the environment itself is important to me, and accuracy is important to me because, you know, you can only ask for so much suspension of disbelief from your reader, right? So you want to get as much of that technical stuff right as you can. For example, when I was trying to conceive the scene where Joseph jumps from the exploding boat and makes his way miraculously to the old Ursuline convent, I needed to walk that route. I needed to see how far it would go because, you know, if I've got him running all the way to City Park, that's not going to work.
Right.
It's got to be quick. It's got to be quick. Got to be, you know, no more than a few blocks. And to my delight, I was able to confirm that. I also, don't laugh, I did one of those really touristy swamp buggy things. I had them take me out there into the Cypress Swamp. I've been on the swamp buggy things before. And as I said, I grew up in Florida. And so, I know the Everglades very well. But the swamp buggy thing was a whole new thing. I needed to get deep into the swamp to see the cypresses. Of course, a lot of the cypresses that would have been towering over the swamps at that time are gone because it's the harvesting that took place late in the 19th century, early 20th century. But, you know, there's still some old soldiers standing there, and you could go out there and they take you deep out and you can get a sense of what it must have been like to go through what would have been skyscrapers of cypresses through the swamps with their curtains of moss just draping everywhere, and just how really evocative that place is. So I also wound up spending quite a bit of time at this historic New Orleans collection out on Royal Street. The staff there was wonderful with me, and the collection there of mid-19th century, late 19th century historical photographs is really extraordinary. If you can ever get in there just spend some time looking at some of those photographs, it's incredible. You have to know what you want to see, though, because everything's filed and they don't want to pull out hundreds of photographs for you. But I knew, for example, that I was very interested in steamboats. I was trying to get a sense of what the levee would have really looked like. The levee, of course, today looks nothing like it looked in 1870. And they've got some extraordinary photographs of just the steamships lined up all the way up the river, all the way up through to the Garden District. It looks like hundreds of steamboats lined up there because that was the transport. And there was no fancy docks or anything. I mean, it was like mud and wood.
You scrambled through it all.
Yeah, steamboats would just kind of like push themselves into the land practically.
So what do you want readers to take away from this book? To think that this was the beginning, this goes back to the earliest days of our great national dilemma?
Well, I want readers to take a couple things away from this book. I want them to like the book, and I want them to enjoy a good ghost story. Because
yes,
really, at the end of the day, like Stephen King says, the story is the most important thing. I think it's a pretty good ghost story.
It is. It is a great ghost story.
Just enjoy the ghost story. And, everybody likes to get creeped out a little bit, right? Like, that. Underneath that, though, is a more important story. It's the story of the larger ghost that haunts our nation. The ghost that still haunts our nation.
Mm-hmm.
And what if you think about ghosts, what does any ghost want, Susan? Any ghost wants... The ghost is always after something. The ghost wants to be acknowledged.
Right.
Right? The ghost always wants to be acknowledged. And we have not acknowledged that ghost. Of course, there are people acknowledging the ghost. Lots of people are acknowledging the ghost. We've come a long way as a country. When things like Charlottesville happen, I look at the news and I say, the ghost is furious.
Mm-hmm.
And the ghost is more alive than ever. And we need to acknowledge this ghost. It's the only way we can move forward as a country and have any sense of peace about this.
Right. We've been talking with John Varese, whose wonderful new book is The Spirit Photographer. You can meet him Friday, May 11th at 6 at the Beauregard Kies House when he appears in conversation with Rosanna Cruz of Race Forward. Or you could meet him Saturday, May 12th at 4 at Community Book Center when he appears in conversation with Tulane University's Roseanne Adderley. John, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Susan. It was a real pleasure.
Hodges has strong Louisiana roots, which is evident in her new book, Saving Bobby, Heroes and Heroine in One Small Community. It's a story of her family and how she and her husband took in her nephew, embarking on the struggle to save him from opioid addiction. It's a harrowing book, all the more so because it is true. Renee Hodges, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. What a wonderful introduction.
So first off, let's hear about those Louisiana roots of yours.
Well, both my husband and I are from Louisiana. We both grew up in Alexandria, and both our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and so on, they were all natives. And even though my father was in the military and I traveled as a child, when he retired back to Louisiana. So I spent my middle school and high school years growing up in Louisiana, and then I couldn't leave. I went to Sophie Newcomb College.
Well, that's strong. That'll tie you to a place for a long time.
And my husband comes from a very large Catholic family. And since we're both from Louisiana, we have relatives spread all over the Gulf Coast now.
Well, that's one of the things about this book that's so charming, is that the Gulf Coast is woven into your family life. From shrimp boils, I mean, you live in North Carolina now, but that's your, you know, one of your celebrations. And you have family reunions at the Grand Hotel in Point Clear.
We do. It's funny, just thinking that you're in New Orleans right now makes my mouth water for a soft-shell crab po' boy.
Well, you'll be here soon.
Soon.
This book is a very detailed account of what happened over the 16 months you took in your nephew, Bobby. And he was living in Louisiana at the time, but you brought him to your home in Durham, North Carolina, to help him struggle with his opioid addiction. And you were really his last chance, it seems, because most of his family had given up on him.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Susan, because I believe his family never gave up on him. I believe they gave over.
Ah.
And Bobby had been struggling with opioid and heroin addiction for about 7 years before he came to North Carolina. He was given a prescription for a back ailment while he was in college in Lafayette. And by the time that he graduated, he was a full-blown addict. So his family intervened 7 years later. There had become this pattern. He went to rehab. He recovered. He was released. And then he would repeat. And this went over and over. And his family, they were at their wit's end. They didn't know what to do. The time that he came to North Carolina, he was just released, I think, from another halfway house. He was living in Florida, and he was about to give up. He wanted to end his life. He'd called his father very despondent, and my brother called me and said, I just don't know what to do. And I actually was the one that suggested he come to North Carolina because we have great medical care here. And I said, let's just get that back looked at. I thought, okay, how easy is this? Let's get the back treated. Well, then we can get him off any drugs that he has to use or feels like he has to use. And then maybe we can have him have a long, sustained recovery. But I didn't realize when he came to North Carolina how sick he really was. So the surprise in the book, and the surprise for me, is that even looking back on it, he was substance-free, Susan, but he was not recovered. He was still in recovery. And he had a long way to go to assimilate back into society. And I'm not so sure that had I known where he was in this stage of recovery, that I might not have even taken him in myself.
And yet you did.
And yet I did.
But you were also a force of nature, practically, because you marshaled all these resources and you had this sense of purpose. And you talked to social workers and medical doctors and church friends, and you looked for employment opportunities for Bobby, even in the really rough times. So you had a really good, strong network for this.
I did, but I used everything. You cannot hide addiction. Hiding and pretending like it's not there is not going to make it go away. It's a disease, just like cancer or heart disease. And I decided, my family decided, Bobby decided, we were going to just be open and honest with our community. And I wrote an email to begin with. Granted, I didn't know when I wrote this email just how powerful this email would affect all of us and affect my community. But people started coming out from everywhere saying, what can I do to help? What does Bobby need? What do you need? The help from the community also helps the caregiver, because those that are not addicted are every bit as affected as those that they're caring for and that do have the disease.
I'm curious, at what point did you know you would write a book about this? Because it's so meticulously documented. You have times and dates and emails that you've sent to people, along with lots of facts and information about addiction. But when did you decide to make a book?
Well, it was actually Bobby that decided to make the book. He came to me when he was leaving, and he said to me, he goes, do you mind writing my story down? Would you mind telling me where I was when I came? I never want to go back to that place. I never want to be a failure again. I want to be able to go back to this. And I was like, well, sure. But I didn't know where to start. So I started going through my computer first, and I guess I don't empty the trash very often because I had emails from well before he was even in the picture. And I started gathering emails, both sent and received. Then I went to my phone. I did text as well. And then I kept a journal. I journaled at night while he was here. I don't normally journal unless I'm under a lot of stress.
Yes.
But when Bobby was here, I had so many doubts, because I am not a licensed professional and I'm not a doctor or a psychologist, that I would write at night to myself to try to alleviate some of the anxiety. And that process allowed me to sleep well. But I had that whole journal. I tell people, I said, when I went back and started reading all of this, I said it was sort of like when I had my children. It was like labor pains. It was so painful. But the moment that it's over, you just forget all about it. And that's sort of what this was. It was like God's chloroform. I did not remember so many of the things that I had gone through because I had this beautiful end result. So I think the reason why the book is so vulnerable is because I wrote it to my nephew. And I opened myself up completely when I was doing that, as I always did with him. But I submitted it to my close friends in my book club, because they lived this. They were mm-hmm. part of the community that did help Bobby. And they said, oh, my gosh, you have got to let us send this to my sister or my neighbor or my friend out in Oregon. And for a couple of weeks after I gave it to them, and I said, sure, if it helps them, just take my name off of it, because I'm not sure about Bobby. I started getting emails and calls. So I asked Bobby, I said, well, what do you think? He says, well, let's turn it into a book, and maybe I can speak about this, and maybe I can help others the way that our community has helped me, and tell them my story. So I went back, thank God for copy editors, and I think one even said, this is cliche hell. And I was like, oh, okay. So it was quite funny to go through the process of writing. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. Bobby did help. I've had a lot of help from professionals because I was not a professional writer. But the story is much more vulnerable and open, and you feel like you're on the journey with me. Or did you feel that? Because I've been told that you feel like you're on this journey.
Oh, I did, absolutely. I mean, you were so open in this book. It's very brave in that way. But I think just as Bobby's story can give addicts courage, your story gives a lot of people who might be hesitant to take on something like this the courage to do that as well.
I hope so. And I hope it also gives people the courage to reach out to those that are in recovery and know that, honestly, we are all in this together. A cliche, I know, but
that's a reason that's a cliche. It's true.
It
is true.
So I think we can do more. And I think that taking the shame and stigma out of the disease is a great first step.
Well, you are very brave to do that in this book. And it is a page turner, I have to say.
Thank you. And can I say that Bobby is very brave to allow me to share his story through this book?
Yes. Yes, great. He is. So how is Bobby now? How does he feel about this book?
He is so excited. Spoiler alert. But I think everybody knows that this is a very, very hopeful book.
It is, very.
And very inspiring. And to those of us that were caregivers, are caregivers, and I think to those in recovery also. Bobby went on to get a master's degree. He left after 16 months with us. He left to get a master's degree. He graduated top of his class while getting several awards for internships. He now is working towards getting a license to go on to be a licensed therapist while he's working in a rehabilitation center. But this time, he's gone back, and he is counseling others that were in the same position that he was.
So amazing. We've been talking with Renee Hodges, whose important new book is Saving Bobby, Heroes and Heroine in One Small Community. You can meet her Tuesday, May 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Renee, thank you so much.
Oh, Susan, thank you so much for letting me share Bobby's story.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Renee Hodges discusses and signs Saving Bobby, Heroes and Heroine in One Small Community, Tuesday, May 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Rosemary James discusses William Faulkner in New Orleans at the meeting of the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library. That's Wednesday, May 9th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Former Tulane University President Scott Cowan discusses and signs his book, Winnebagoes on Wednesdays, How Visionary Leadership Can Transform Higher Education. Wednesday, May 9th at 7 at the New Orleans Advocate, 840 St. Charles Avenue. This is a ticketed event, but tickets are free. Reserve yours at eventbrite.com. Mark Matrona discusses and signs Southern Splendor, Saving Architectural Treasures of the Old South, Thursday, May 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Lisa Poche Calhoun discusses her science fiction novel, Super Flare, The Fortunate Ones, Thursday, May 10th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. John Michael Varesi discusses and signs The Spirit Photographer, Friday, May 11th at 6 at the Beauregard Kais House, where he appears in conversation with Rosanna Cruz of Race Forward. He also appears in conversation with Tulane University's Roseanne Adderley. That's Saturday, May 12th at 4 at Community Book Center. A happy reminder, Saturday, May 12th is Independent Bookstore Day in New Orleans. Celebrated at your local indie, these stores, Blue Cypress Books, Garden District Bookshop, Octavia Books, and Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop, will feature special merchandise and a scavenger hunt. Enjoy! Participants from the In the Garden Writers Workshop, hosted by poet Delia Tomino Nakayama, present a reading in the garden Saturday, May 12th from 2 to 4 at the Alvar Branch Library of the New Orleans Public Library. 100,000 Poets for Change presents a wetlands poetry tour. That's poetry for Aguada, Spirit Water, Lake Pontchartrain, Okalock, the Gulf of Mexico, and your local bayous Bonfuca or St. John. The event features Paul Cadafago, Jonathan Penton, Jessica Michelle Bordelon, Valentine Pierce, Gina Ferrara, Liz Garcia, and Dennis Formento. Saturday, May 12th from 2 to 4 at Antenna Gallery, 3512 St. Claude Avenue. And just a reminder, the main library of the New Orleans Public Library is closed through May 13th for renovations. Coming up, Whitney Stewart, author of What's on Your Plate? Exploring the World of Food, and Mindful Me, Mindfulness and Meditation for Kids, will be part of the Raising Kind Kids in Today's World one-day seminar. That's Wednesday, May 16th from 9 to 3 at the Ace Hotel, 600 Carondelet Street. It's for parents, educators, therapists, grandparents, and caring adults. Go to barefootbooks.com/kindkids for ticket information. Also getting close, June 1st through 3rd is the annual Walker Percy Weekend in West Feliciano Parish, with an emphasis this year on the work of Shelby Foote as well. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org to buy tickets, and the event is headquartered at Conundrum Books in St. Francisville. And here at The Reading Life, we're celebrating New Orleans' tricentennial by putting together a list of 300 great books about New Orleans. Send us your favorites. The address is labooks@wwno.org. See if they make the list. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.